San Bruno, Parkland, Sutherland Springs, Las Vegas, Orlando, San Bernardino. Over the past few years, we've seen an increase of both ideological and non-ideological active shooter threats all over the country. Stay tuned to this week's episode as we discuss efforts within our state to prepare for such events and how these trainings could potentially save lives.
This is Director Jared Maples of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Welcome back to Season 3 of Intelligence Unclassified, a podcast about counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. Join us as we talk to local and national experts in these fields to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and offer you a unique perspective on current trends and issues facing our great state. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed, iTunes, or Google Play. You can also follow NJOHSP on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at NJOHSP. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njohsp.gov.
My name is Alyssa Potter, and I am an intelligence analyst here with NJOHSP. I'm here today with two state experts on active shooter situations, Ed Moore, NJOHSP's active shooter trainer, and Ben Castillo, Director of the New Jersey Department of Education's Office of School Preparedness and Emergency Planning. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today. First off, what is an active shooter scenario and how can it differ from terrorist attacks?
Well, an active shooter incident is one is where you have an individual or individuals attempting to kill in a populated area. Although they do encompass terrorist attacks, a terrorist attack would have to have a motivation of looking to make a social or political change.
What is described as the mindset of an active shooter?
That would be an individual for whatever motivation. It could be revenge. It could be personal grievance. It could be somebody who's having maybe some mental difficulties. It could be workplace violence who just goes and they look to kill as many people as they can. Some of them are looking to make a statement and also to, since a lot of them are loners, also get notoriety for themselves.
We hear about these a lot in the news lately. How common are these events?
Well, with regard to the active shooter in a school setting, they are statistically rare. While the outcome may be very, very tragic, schools remain very safe places for students on a daily basis. When one considers the number of schools throughout the country and the number of students that attend, they do remain very, very safe places to be.
Benny makes a good point because most of these incidents happen, 43% take place in an area of commerce. So it'd be like your stores, commercial facilities, and facilities such as that.
Can either of you comment on how long typically do active shooter events or situations last?
On an average, they're about 12 minutes. However, there have some that have gone on longer, such as Las Vegas and also the Washington Naval Yard shooter, which Washington Naval Yard shooting actually went on for several hours.
Right, Ed. And if I can tag on from that, I believe those statistics with regard to the 12-minute average is based upon a national average. It's important to note that here in New Jersey, because we're such a small state, we have a number of municipalities that are very close to one another. Police response in this state, I would imagine, would be substantially less.
What would you suggest are some best practices for coping with an active shooter situation?
Well, once again, Alyssa, within the school environment, it's important to remember that we do perform mandatory drills. We have to do here in New Jersey one security drill each month. That's in addition to the mandatory fire drills that we must do. And there should be some solace taken in that we are preparing. We are doing something to be able to respond to an active shooter.
That's also true in the public and private sector also, because what we're doing right now is we're going around the state and training private and public sector in the run, hide, fight. Also assisting them in developing emergency action plans, looking at their sites, see how they can up their security. And then again, practice and drilling just like the schools do, because you know practicing it will make people familiar with what they have to do if a situation occurs.
So the more they practice, the more prepared they should be if one of these situations should occur.
Correct.
We're familiar with the run, hide, fight response. Should someone always follow that order in assessing the appropriate response to this type of situation, or are there special circumstances?
There'd be special circumstances. A person may walk into an active shooter, may not have time to run. They may go right into the fight mode, or the shooter could walk into them. that would change the dynamics. You may have somebody who runs to go to a place to hide. So that way, we can get them into a safe area so they don't have to run so far. We have to look at our population. We have a working population that's also a little older too. Same thing in churches. You have the older population where they can't, they're not as mobile. So we have to find out other strategies we can do to protect them also.
Yes, thanks for bringing that up, Alyssa. Often people see that run, hide, fight process and they think that run is, you know, their first option. However, from what we've seen in our visits in over 800 schools, we've conducted unannounced drill observations. And what we see there is the capability to lock down in all of the classrooms that we visited. So what we try to do is train to that to be our first option. And of course, as Ed had mentioned, you're not always in an area where you can lock down. So we have to make sure that other options are practiced as well.
To follow up on what he said, schools actually are more designed with the heavy walls, wooden doors, and also now with the communication system to be able to lock down. And now they're changing some of the fire codes in certain municipalities also. They can lock the doors. And teachers are trained how to barricade the doors and you can make kids safe. You can't take 20 classes from 25 kids and dump them in the hallways with a shooter and expect a successful outcome. We use the run, hide, fight more for adults in the private public sector because, again, they're not always in the same place. They have to make decisions for themselves. So, again, dynamics are a little bit different. But also, if you had, even the schools, every building's different. So each one of them has to have a different type of emergency action plan to be able to respond.
I think people always are surprised when there's a suggestion that someone should attack a person with a gun, an active shooter, go after an active shooter, hit them with a hammer or anything you have available. What is your advice on that?
We're not telling anybody to come out of a hiding place or to run across the room to attack a shooter if they can keep themselves safe. But if it's a last resort, they have to fight for their life. And the best thing to do is with a weapon. If the shooter's got a weapon, you've got to have something also to be able to stop them. And everything you have, you got to think about what you can use as improvised weapons.
Switching gears, how should someone respond when law enforcement arrives? And why is this important?
Stay out of their way. Don't ask them questions. The first responding officer's job when they get there is to go to stop the shooter. It's to stop the killing, then stop the dying. So they are not going to help anybody right away. They're going to go right and take out that shooter. The faster they can stop that shooter, the less people they're going to die. And that's really the way they're operating and training right now.
And that also holds true for schools. That's one of the important parts of being able to drill. That would bring law enforcement into the schools to practice their response and gives them an opportunity to create some kind of dialogue so that the students and staff know what the emergency responders would expect.
If, for example, I am in an active shooter situation, what would you suggest? Would you suggest that I immediately run or go hide, or should I help someone that maybe needs assistance? Should I think of myself first, or should I think of helping someone else if I'm in this situation? Trick question.
You can help somebody if you can. There are people who are going to freeze, and you might not even be able to pull them out of it because they're just going to freeze and you can't move them. If that's the case, if you can stuff them in a closet or do something, get them under a desk, then get out yourself. The best thing you can do is try to get out of that building. You want to try to get away from where the shooter is, but also when law enforcement arrives, if there's shooting going on, you want to try to get out of the building if you can, because again, bullets start flying. You just want to be in an area where you're safe. And sometimes that's out of the building.
And generally the same thing holds true for schools. However, in schools, often the teachers and staff are going to be the adults in the room. So there is an additional responsibility to ensure, the safety of their students. So that's once again why it is so important in a pre-planning stage to understand what challenges maybe some students might have and try to prepare for any type of emergency that might arise.
We touched on this briefly earlier, but are there different responses depending on the location? For example, schools, religious facilities, or a commercial business like a mall or something like that?
Yes. Number one, you have different dynamics because, again, your religious facilities are different than a theater. You've got a lot of people, limited ingress and egress areas. And when a shooter comes in, you've got to be able to move people and get them out. A mall, people have more mobility and a bigger area. They're not as confined. And then it depends on the businesses and stuff too, how their setup is, how they're going to get out. But the main thing is that you want to try to get people and move them out. If they stay still, the shooter's going to shoot them. You have to try to get away if you can, or look for cover, something that will stop a bullet, and stay low, but try to move people out. We're trying to change the religious facilities that they have to try to move people. And then the businesses, the same thing, if they can get them out. But then businesses also have, a lot of times they have offices they can lock down in or storage rooms where they can hide in also. And that's what we're trying to tell them to do. If they have other means, like you said, you know, they can run or they can hide if they have that capability.
And once again, within the school setting, if we look at an individual school or campus, much of it can be situational. For example, do as much as we can to drill to an active shooter event. However, if class is outside on a playground, you know, if they're outdoor in gym and an alert goes off, then of course they would have to take a different action. You know, once the threat were inside, then they have to be sure to go to a pre-designated place away from the school rather than locking down.
That was my next question. Especially in schools, does everyone have a detailed plan for wherever they go? Or like you said, if an event starts occurring, is there somewhere, you know, place to gather and then go from there? How do schools handle that, especially when you have kids moving around all day?
Yes, that's one of our main messages, is that we have to be able to plan, you know, throughout the school day. You can imagine during arrival, there are a number of students that are waiting to get inside the building. Dismissal poses another particular problem. And then even within the school, there are, you know, certain challenges where there might be, in a particular building, very little room in terms of where someone might be able to hide. So a lot of it depends upon, you know, time of day. If there are a number of students that are gathered for a lunch period, for example, large assemblies. And these are all areas that we train to and we speak to our school administrators about. Ed, I think you have some additional information on that.
We're trying to get businesses to develop plans. We're working with them. We do go out. We run an active shooter workshop periodically throughout the state where it actually helps people make their plans. With adults, a little bit different because, again, a lot of times in different parts of the building, they're not going in groups. So, again, individuals have to make their own decisions. And that's why it's a little different in schools, because schools, your kids are guided around by a teacher most of the time, or they have some type of supervision where adults aren't being supervised. They could be anywhere in a building or even in another building. Or even going outside indoors or indoors to out, where active shooters take place indoors and outdoors. We have to be able to react to that. And like I said, adults have to be able to make those decisions wherever they're at.
For our office in particular, what are we doing to prepare citizens for these kinds of events?
Well, right now we're going around the state and we're training them in the run, hide, fight so they have an understanding. We're also putting on the workshops so they can get their organization planning done and also work on their policies and procedures so that it helps them in their response. And we also have resources online. We have a video online, the Run, Hide, Fight video that we have. Then we also have resources. If you look on there, under the resources under njohsp.gov, you look under active shooter resources. We have resources from FEMA, DHS, and also the FBI, which even has some of the reports in there they can take a look at, when, you know, if they want to conduct their own training. But again, the big thing is, I think, is that training and have an understanding of what they can do is the biggest thing that we're trying to do, is get around the state and even all size businesses. I mean, I've actually trained a business as small as 12 people and all the way up to almost 2,000 people.
For either of you, are there any indicators that maybe teachers or business owners should report as far as suspicious activity for active shooters? I know it's probably similar to what we look for in counterterrorism. If someone's surveilling a place or, you know, looks out of place, is there anything that someone that might be listening to this podcast could call in if they see suspicious? Is there anything in particular?
I don't think there's anything that you want to say is suspicious. What we look for is changes in personalities, because sometimes people go through a progression. And whatever sets them off, keep an eye, because you can see people, sometimes they can become depressed. Maybe there's some incident that set them, you know, is getting them set off to make them think about doing these shootings. But the big thing we look at is if you see these subtle changes, if somebody starts really examining these past active shooter events and researching them, and also has just become up with this desire to acquire weapons or even explosives, they never had that desire before, that's somebody we need to take a good look at. Again, it could be somebody that was building stages, and that's what we want to try to do to stop these. We're trying to stop them before they even happen. And if they do happen, we're going to try to mitigate casualties. I think that's where all the training and the exercising, having communications built up and within your capabilities. Also, one thing we didn't talk about was assessing facilities. We go around and we take a look at facilities. I know Benny does it for the schools, and we also do it in the private and public sector. Take a look what security they have and where their gaps are, so that we can tighten these up a little bit. Because a lot of times you can prevent people from doing these shootings within the facility by having better security measures, checking bags, sometimes having security cameras where somebody's watching the cameras all the time, cutting out areas of ingress and egress. Schools have done a very good job of that throughout the state, where they usually have a supervisor or somebody sitting there when people come through the door to be able to vet them when they come in through the door. A lot of businesses still don't have that. They may not have the concern, but they should have somebody to watch them before they get in the main part of the building if they can. Again, it's just a matter of looking at your security measures and then see what you're trying to, see what the threats are, see what you're trying to stop, and then come up with proper security.
Right. In addition to what you said earlier, you know, within the schools, in many cases, kids are going to school together from K all the way up through 12. They're socializing, they're making friends, and Ed had mentioned, a lot can be said for, you know, those behavioral indicators. Ed mentioned if there's something somewhat out of the ordinary, if you have a friend of yours that perhaps is acting differently, particularly in those cases where maybe there may have been an event that occurred. A lot's being done within education to improve the culture and climate within our schools. There are programs to reduce the numbers of incidents of harassment, intimidation, and bullying. So we are taking a look at the mental health aspects as well. And much of these little indicators have been seen cropping up either verbally or online. So that would also present an opportunity to be able to see something maybe suspicious out of the ordinary and then provide that information to the authorities or to school administrators.
Even in the business sector, there are certain indicators also. A lot of these shooters have shown a propensity towards, you know, maybe making verbal comments to certain people, maybe aggressive actions. Again, that might be the beginning of them going to these active shooter stage. It's not the only factor. You have to look at a lot of things combined. And when you put it all together before you just start pointing a finger at somebody, because again, there are people who have started, you know, acquiring weapons and they like to shoot, which is totally different than somebody's acquiring them to go out and do a mass shooting. But again, if other behaviors, those indicators that are suspicious, then that's really something to be reported. I know in San Bernardino, the neighbor came out after that shooting. He said he saw something suspicious going on in the garage, but he didn't report it because he didn't want to seem like he was profiling because they were Muslim. Well, what we tell people is don't use race, religion, or address. Use the actions. If it looks like it's suspicious or it's illegal, report it. Let the police handle it and let them follow up.
Just in closing, what other resources would you suggest people taking a look at to be prepared for some kind of active shooter situation? I know Ed mentioned our website, njohsp.gov, and we specifically have an active shooter tab on there where you can go to be redirected to the DHS active shooter information. Benny, as far as Department of Education, do you want to mention any resources that you have?
Thanks, Alyssa. Yes, on our NJDOE website, if you just go to that website and just click on S, that will bring you to School Preparedness Emergency Planning or under School Safety and Security. We have a number of links to many organizations which have helpful information, among them being OHSP, New Jersey State Police, Readiness and Emergency Management for Schools, New Jersey's OEM office, as well as FEMA.
I think also as a parent of a school-age child, it's good for parents to go and look at these resources and find out what their children are doing in school and, you know, talk to them about the drilling that goes on. I know I talked to my daughter, she's only 7, but they have these drills and, you know, they seem to go well where they're not scaring the children. So I think that's important to mention.
You make a good point there as far as we're not trying to scare anybody. We want to make people aware, because if you have awareness, you have prepared. Again, this is a preparedness side of our house, looking how we can prepare advance. How can we prep ourselves to be ready if something does happen? We're not waiting to figure it out when it happens. Because what happens if you wait and you don't know what to do, you're going to freeze. And that's what gets people hurt. We want to plan in advance and have a game plan for everybody so that they understand. And again, it's that awareness. And, you know, people get afraid because they don't know. By making you more aware, you can take some of that fear out of it and just make it like even the schools now where they are drilling. The kids know if something happens, they know what to do. It's no different than what back in the 60s. We used to hide under the desk for nuclear blasts. It didn't scare us. We just knew that it was something we had to practice after a while. So, again, they can become familiar with it.
Alyssa, thanks for sharing that experience with your daughter. And that's certainly true. We do see that, you know, as these kids grow up, and unfortunately, it is pretty much a new normal as far as what we see. However, they have demonstrated a lot of resiliency in dealing with this. And as Ed had mentioned, you know, doing these drills, having these plans, going through them, allow us those opportunities to practice and maybe feel a little bit better prepared for those things.
Well, thank you very much, Ed and Benny, for sharing your resources and information with us.
I think it's important for everybody to have an understanding of what they can and can't do, even in their personal lives. I think the run, hide, fight, then we teach it. It's not just in the business sector. It's also when you go out on your own. These happen everywhere. They happen in stores. It's happened in restaurants. We just saw the Waffle House down south. I mean, these are things we have to be careful of and just be aware. And the big thing is having that self-awareness. Not have your head buried in the phone all the time. Just be aware that somebody's behavior, see somebody acting suspiciously. And again, but we have to be able to enjoy our lives, not be on high alert all the time, but just have that enough self-awareness that we know if something happens that we can respond.
Thanks for the opportunity. And I'd just like to appeal to you once again as a parent. You may see some increased efforts, occurring in your schools. Don't take it personally. It may be more difficult for you to visit your child, in a school. But, that's there for a reason. It's all about keeping the kids safe. And I think the schools are really doing a good job at trying to improve their security postures.
If you enjoyed this podcast or you have further comments, please rate us on iTunes. It's Intel Unclassified. Or you can contact us via Twitter at NJOHSP.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.